This weekend, the world of football will be focused squarely on Indianapolis and the 2012 Super Bowl. We will scrutinize every play, celebrate every fumbled ball by the other guy, every sack, every return, every touchdown, you name it. But will you consider that the average force with which a football must be kicked during kickoff is 450 pounds, and that for an instant, the force may be as much as a ton? I didn't think so. That's why we invited Timothy Gay to the show. Timothy Gay earned his PhD in atomic physics from the University of Chicago. He has been a professor of physics at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln for going on 2 decades. He also studies electron and neutrino physics. But what has really gained him notice from the likes of the Wall Street Journal, ESPN, People Magazine, ABC World News Tonight, and NPR is his accumulated knowledge of the physics of football, the science behind those bone-crunching hits and other feats of the game. Timothy Gay is in Columbus today to speak at the Ohio State University Department of Physics. For more information on that, you can go to the link at our website at wosu.org/allsides. He took some time out to join us for a quick primer on the physics of football, the title, by the way, of his book on the topic. Welcome to the show, Timothy.
Hi, and thank you for having me on.
You actually played college football, but your interest in the physics of the game reaches farther back. Tell us about that.
I was an undergraduate at Caltech, and their football team was sufficiently lousy that I could actually make it. So I played for them for 3 years and loved every minute of it. It was a great experience, but we weren't such a great team. But I'd always been interested in football. I was the manager of my high school team and was a sort of a budding physicist at that point, and became very interested in the mechanics of how the game was played and maybe some things that could perhaps improve the play if you understood a little bit of physics.
So first of all, let's talk about the basics of physics, you know, for the uninitiated and how the knowledge of physics might enhance the experience for the typical football fan.
Yeah, when you watch a game of football, basically what you're seeing is being governed by classical physics. Classical physics being defined as physics before 1895, roughly. That was essentially invented by Sir Isaac Newton and some others. Newton was very interested in mechanics, how bodies, how masses interact with each other, how forces change motion, and he came up with Newton's three laws, which really essentially govern all mechanical aspects of the game. So when you watch football, the thing that's important is this old school classical physics, if you will. Knowing just a little bit about that physics really, I think, can help you be a better player, but it can also help you enjoy the game a little more when you watch some of the details of what's going on the field.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Timothy Gay, a physics professor at the University of Nebraska. He's also author of the book. It's called The Physics of Football, Discover the Science of Bone-Crunching Hits, Soaring Field Goals, and Awe-Inspiring Passes. If you have a question or comment for Timothy Gay, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page or tweet us at Ann Fisher, WOSU. Is there a play out there that's stuck in your brain and you've always wondered, how did that happen? How did they make that work? Timothy might have an answer for you, some kind of explanation. So give us a call if you have a question, 614-292-8513. You actually have taught football physics at Nebraska to Nebraska fans, and I really had to read back over it a couple times to grasp the fact that you were doing this at the football games. How did that work?
Yeah, it was interesting that the director of Husker Vision, which is the audiovisual arm of the athletic department at Nebraska, actually responsible for the content that they put up on the big jumbotrons in Memorial Stadium, thought it would be an interesting novelty to you know, associate football with some kind of science. And so he sent a producer over to the physics department, and she walked into the front office and said, "Do you have any physics professors that love football that are shameless self-promoters. Of course, they stood up in unison and said, well, that would be Tim Gay. So she came down and pitched it to me, and didn't have to pitch very hard because it's something, as we mentioned, I've always loved. And so we just started writing some scripts, and they turned into one-minute pieces that were run typically during a timeout in the second or third quarter. And as I say, lasted for about a minute and a half, and tried to emphasize some point maybe of a play from the last game, or just something fun that the fans could relate to.
And could they? I mean, how did it come across?
It went well. One had to be very careful in those pieces to limit it to about a minute, or at most a minute 15. Football fans have a short attention span, and they want to get back to the game. And I noticed a couple of times when the piece ran over 2 minutes, they were starting to fidget and look around for something else to do. But you keep it to a minute, and it can be an effective way to teach.
And then you did it again. Was it for ABC?
No, I did it for NFL.
NFL
Films. Did similar pieces. The nice thing about those was, being a naturally long-winded professor, I want to just go on and on. And NFL let me have 5 minutes as opposed to 1 minute. So that was a lot of fun.
Well, let's get to the physics. In the first chapter on blocking and tackling, it revolves around Sir Isaac Newton's three laws of physics. So let's talk about Newton's first law of physics. In Super Bowl 20, the Bears were playing the Patriots. In this clip from the game, the Bears were on the one-yard line and went with an unconventional running back.
And I wonder who's going to get the call on this one-yard line. Henry. That one registered 3.8. Another Super Bowl record. The first refrigerator to score. And the largest running back ever to score a touchdown.
That, of course, was defensive lineman William Perry playing offense and literally barreling his way through the line to score a touchdown. He was 6'2", more than 300 pounds. Could anyone really stop him anyways? After all, they called him, they mentioned the refrigerator for a reason.
Yeah, this is a classic play, and it illustrates the first of Newton's three laws, which is that essentially mass wants to do what it was doing before, at the risk of being overly anthropomorphic. Mass is essentially our gauge of how many atoms there are in something, how much something weighs, and mass will continue to move at the same speed in a straight line unless some force acts on it. And then the more massive it is, the less effective a force will be in changing its direction or its speed. So you get a guy like the refrigerator, who, as you say, was well over 300 pounds. And he gets up ahead of steam, and Perry was quick. I mean, he could get moving fast. And, you see that play, and the players are just bouncing off of him. It's like, throwing a bowling ball through a bunch of ping pong balls. Mass really wants to do what it was doing before, and that play illustrates it beautifully.
You talk about, I was going to ask you later, but might as well bring it up now. You note that there's a difference between speed and quickness. What's the difference?
Yeah, that's very important. So speed is essentially how fast you accelerate. So a person can, with very little athletic ability, such as myself, if they are muscular and have a relatively small mass, they can apply a large force and get moving quickly. They can move their muscles quickly and get up to speed, and they can hit hard. That's important for a lineman. A lineman doesn't have to do a 4.340. He just has to hit the guy across the line hard. So quickness is basically how fast you can get up to some working speed. But a person that's fast is entirely different. A person that's fast has to have athletic ability and has to be able to run at high speed, and that takes not so much physics, not so much force to mass ratio, but takes coordination, and you have to know how to move your muscles correctly. So I always tell people when I played ball, I was a weak side tackle, and I was one of the quicker guys on the team. I worked out and had a lot of muscles, but I was not particularly coordinated. So I was one of the fastest guys on the team. I was one of the quickest guys on the team. I was also one of the slowest guys on the team.
If you have a question or comment, is there a football play out there that you've always wondered about? How did that happen? How could they do that? How did they get away with that? Well, maybe that's not the right way to put that, but how did it happen? What made it happen? Give us a call, because my guest is Timothy Gaze, a physics professor. He's written a book called The Physics of Football. He may know the answer. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You wrote that the first law does not have or does have some not so obvious consequences, and you explain that with a description of an experiment you do with your first year physics classes. It's an experiment with bricks.
Yeah, that's you know, you talk about all this stuff and especially Newton's three laws, and people come up to me and they say, well, wait a minute, professor, you know, what you're really saying is it's better to be a quick, fast, big guy than a slow, small guy. Well, duh, I didn't need to take a physics class to know that. And it's true. It's better to be big and fast than small and slow. But there are some subtleties to these laws. And one example, we talked about the refrigerator Perry play. That illustrates the first law. One experiment I do to also illustrate the first law, which is kind of counterintuitive, is I take a lead brick, which weighs about 30 pounds, and a wooden brick, which weighs perhaps 2 pounds, same size. You carefully balance them on a couple of styrofoam coffee cups. So I've got 2 coffee cups balancing the lead brick just barely, because it almost crushes them just sitting there. And then I have a wood brick also supported by 2 more coffee cups. And then you take a lead weight weighing perhaps 2 pounds. It doesn't matter that it's lead. You drop it from a height of perhaps 1 meter, and you say, which brick will be more effective at crushing the coffee cups? And most people, even some of those that have taken a physics course, will say, oh, it's going to be the lead brick because it's much more massive. But in fact, it's the wooden brick, which is much more effective at crushing the coffee cups, because the wood brick is more effectively accelerated when it's hit with the dropping weight. The lead brick is very massive. Mass wants to do what it was doing before, and what it was doing before was sitting stock still. So that mass dropping on it doesn't accelerate it, and the coffee cups are, at least on good days when the demonstration works, not crushed.
We're going to take a break. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with Timothy Gaze. He's author of The Physics of Football, Discover the Science of Bone-Crunching Hits, Soaring Field Goals, and Awe-Inspiring Passes. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Every day, All Sides with Ann Fisher discusses the issues you are talking about. And Margaret from Upper Arlington, you're on the air. Welcome to the show. An email from Kate in Victorian Village and Matt in Columbus. Welcome to the show. Join me weekdays from 10 a.m. to noon for discussions of city politics, statewide issues, books, the arts, and more. Listen to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News or find All Sides at WOSU.org/allsides.
Checking the weather forecast for Central Ohio, today mostly sunny and a high approaching 60 degrees. Tonight, showers likely later on and a low of 46 overnight. Wednesday, showers likely in the morning and then the skies will gradually clear. Mostly sunny tomorrow afternoon with a high of 54 degrees. Wednesday night, cloudy and a low of 34, but the sunshine comes back on Thursday and the high expected on Thursday is 49 degrees, most unseasonable weather for Central Ohio. Right now, at our studios here on the Ohio State University campus, we have 48 degrees and some sunshine, too.
Welcome back. We're talking with Timothy Gaze. He's a physics professor at the University of Nebraska and author of the book, The Physics of Football. He's at the Ohio State campus today. If you want to learn more about why, you can go to our website at WOSU.org/allsides. If you would like to speak with Timothy Gaze, you're welcome, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Janet in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Janet.
Oh, hi. I had a question for him. Tim, how did the gentleman from Kansas City kick the 63-yard field goal? I believe his name was Tom something or other, the longest field goal.
Yeah, 63 yards is the record. I know Jason Elam tied it. And the other fellow, so that may have been the Kansas City game. I'm getting old and my memory's going. But, yeah, I you're right. And the answer to your question is that to kick a 63-yard field goal requires great skill. And basically two things are needed. One is a large amount of force, which is generated by very high foot speed. You do that by essentially whipping your lower leg at the last second before you make contact with the ball. But most NFL kickers, I would venture to say all NFL kickers, have a good enough have enough talent to in effect kick a ball that far. The problem then becomes the details of how your foot contacts the ball. The football is inherently an asymmetric object. It's got seams. It's got laces. Of course, you're not kicking the laces, but it's got imperfections, small imperfections, as does your shoe. And it's very, very hard to have the ball contacted perfectly by your foot and your foot have your foot direct the force exactly toward the field goal. Of course, wind can come in as well. It's something like the butterfly effect. If I make a very small error in the way I kick, it might be okay for a while, but then it gets magnified as the ball moves down the field. So you essentially have to be lucky. It's kind of like throwing the dice, and you just happen to put your foot perfectly on the ball for that one kick, meaning that it goes through. But of course, it might also work if you didn't quite put your foot perfectly on the ball, but the wind was blowing the right way. So the further away you get from the uprights, the harder it is to aim the ball with the accuracy that you need. Interestingly, I appreciate your question because it brings up another point, which is that the record in college is 72 yards. And you say, well, wait a minute. I mean, college kickers aren't as good as pro kickers. How can they kick it further? And the answer is very simply, it's the statistics of large numbers. You've got a lot more college kickers trying, and every once in a while, they're going to get lucky. Even a blind pig finds an acorn once in a while, and every once in a while, you'll get one of those super long kicks. But it's really, once you've met the requisite barrier for talent, you have enough leg strength to kick it that far, then luck comes into it as well.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thanks, Janet. 614-292-8513, that's the number to call if you have a question for our guest, Timothy Gay, author of The Physics of Football. Let's go back to that kick issue for a minute. You talked about, I know we're jumping ahead to Newton's third law, but you talk about how Newton's third law of physics sort of debunks the notion that punters and kickers often have of a ball's sweet spot and how connecting with that will get them longer and straighter kicks. So why is that? And how else does the third law come into play or not?
Yeah, that's almost a semantic issue. There is certainly it depends on what you mean by a sweet spot. Typically, when we talk about a sweet spot, we're thinking of batting in baseball. And you say, well, there's a spot on the bat where you should hit the ball. There's something of a controversy about what the nature of that sweet spot is, but in terms of physics, one would either say that it is the center of percussion, or it is the node of the first harmonica vibration of the bat. Those are big fancy words, but basically, think about it this way: if I have a bat and I hit it with a ball, there is one point on the bat that for a second doesn't move because the bat is rotating about that point. If that's where you grip, if that's where you're gripping the bat, then you won't feel the bat move under your hands, and that means that it's essentially a more comfortable experience for the batter. So that's the sweet spot, the center of percussion. I should also mention that some people think that's not the right theory, that in fact the bat vibrates and the bat will vibrate in what's called a normal mode, just like an organ pipe. And in an organ pipe, there is a point where the air doesn't move. It's called the node of the organ pipe. And essentially by hitting the bat with the ball, if your hands are over the place on the bat where it doesn't move, kind of like a guitar string, then you won't feel that vibration. So that's the sweet spot. Interestingly, either theory gives about the same answer for where the sweet spot is. So leaving that issue alone, the football doesn't have an equivalent point, either a vibration or a center of percussion. So there's no such thing per se as a sweet spot, but there is a point where you want to kick the ball. I don't think your foot feels any better no matter where you kick it, but there is a place where you'll get the most distance because you direct the force through the center of mass of the ball, leading to the longest distance.
Do football players really think about all this stuff?
No. That's a good point. When I was writing the book, I had a couple of football coaches say, you know, how is this going to help me coach better? And I had to be honest. I'd say it's probably not going to be that influential because you know most of this stuff already. One of the fascinating things in writing the book for me was I learned a lot from talking to football players and football coaches. And a good coach, of course, knows what works and what doesn't work. So they're gonna tell their players the right thing. The intellectual interest for me was in understanding the physics of why that thing they know to work, why that doesn't in fact work. But I was having a conversation with a coach who at one point will be in the Super Bowl, that is to say Bill Belichick.
And, well, who wrote the foreword, by the way?
He wrote the foreword of the book. And he said, you know, do I really have time to read this book? I'm a busy guy. And I said, well, you know, it's not going to help you get a lot of points, but it might help you get 3 points every fifth year. Do you want the 3 points? He said, oh, yeah. And he went away and read the book.
614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Let's listen to one of the most famous plays in football. It's called the Immaculate Reception. In the 1972 AFC Divisional Playoffs, Pittsburgh Steelers fullback Franco Harris made an incredible catch with just 5 seconds to go and beat the Oakland Raiders.
Last chance for the Steelers. Patcha trying to get away. And his pass is broken up by Tatum. Tipped off. Franco Harris has it. And he's over. Franco Harris.
So you say that this play demonstrates the principle of conservation of momentum in physics. How does that work?
Well, yeah, this is actually one of the best examples of where physics can really have an impact or at least give you an important understanding of football. That play is famous because at the time in 1972 in the AFC, if the ball touched a player who didn't actually end up making the catch, it was ruled an incomplete pass. So the pass was thrown to a running back by the name of Frenchy Fuqua. Was deflected into the arms of Franco Harris, who then ran it in. So if Frenchy had been the first one to touch the ball, then it would have not been a legitimate score. And, of course, this was very controversial. In fact, the referees ruled it as being a score, and, of course, that's why the Steelers went on to win the AFC. Now, at the same time, OSU great Jack Tatum was lining up to tackle Fuqua, and Tatum's OSU fans will, of course, remember his tackling. He was known affectionately throughout the league as the assassin because he was one of the hardest hitting, one of the greatest tacklers to ever play the game. And he was lining up to hit Fuqua, but no one ever saw the hit. The television cameras were unable to actually show the hit and what actually happened with the ball. So there was always some controversy. The referees said that it was a Pittsburgh score, but no one was ever sure. It turns out, though, that if you analyze what Tatum and Fuqua were doing, Fuqua was basically standing there with arms outstretched, and Tatum was coming in like a shot. The ball recoils with high speed, and so that shows that it must have hit Tatum. This is the principle of conservation of momentum, and was actually first pointed out by a professor of physics, interestingly, at the University of Pittsburgh, who made the point that conservation of energy of momentum demanded that, in fact, Fuqua was not the first to touch the ball. It was Tatum, and therefore it was a legitimate call. The referees were right. So their physics leads to understanding, although, of course, it's not going to lead to the referee call being reversed, as indeed it should not have been.
If you're just dropping in, my guest is Timothy Gay. He's a physics professor at the University of Nebraska. He's also author of a book. It's called The Physics of Football: Discover the Science of Bone-Crunching Hits, Soaring Field Goals, and Awe-Inspiring Passes. Is there a question about a play that sticks in your mind all these years? How did that happen? Timothy Gay might be able to answer your question. 614-292-8513. And you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Tim in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yes, I was hoping the professor could explain why head trauma occurs between a safety and a receiver, where the mass moves over a greater distance before the collision, and why head trauma is also occurring between an offensive and defensive lineman, where there's only inches between the players.
Yeah,
that's a
great question, Tim. The answer is that head trauma can occur at just about any time. It is certainly true that collisions between receivers and safeties are more violent, tending to involve helmets more often than collisions between linemen. But and they're finding this out now. You can get a concussion from a relatively small blow, and no football helmet in the world is going to protect you from that. So what I would say is that the safeties, have bigger hits. They're more likely to produce an immediate risk of a concussion. But the linemen are kind of getting hit at a lower level, but repeatedly, over and over and over. So I'd say basically the chance of getting a serious debilitating concussion is probably about the same. There are no studies of this that I'm aware of, but it's probably about the same when you average over all of the plays for both the people in the backfield and the linemen.
We have an email from Robert in Worthington. He says, over the years, there are many more rather spectacular one-hand catches by receivers in football. If this is correct, why is this so? Better eye-hand coordination, quickness in hand response, receivers with larger hands, the gloves receivers now wear? Any comments?
Yeah, that's an interesting point. And, of course, the glove manufacturers work hard on making gloves that help you catch, and I think they're effective. So one answer would be the gloves, I think, have improved things. The other thing I would say is just an overall improving level of athleticism. The people that are playing the game today are better athletes than the people that played the game 50 years ago. They're in better shape. They've concentrated more on the position they're playing, and you're just seeing a better level of play.
The West Coast offense, the passing game, first perfected, well, we came to fruition apparently in the 80s with Joe Montana and Jerry Rice of the San Francisco 49ers and in the 1980s, I guess. But they developed back in the 1960s, you wrote. It gets its own chapter in your book, its very own chapter, and it starts with timing and the quarterback.
Yeah, timing is of course crucial. This is one of the things. This is why NFL quarterbacks earn their money. The timing that's required to throw a short pass or a long pass really has to be accurate to tenths of seconds. And that requires practice. These guys go over these plays over and over again, and just a slight miscalculation is the difference between 6 points and not making it to the championship. The ballet of the West Coast offense is always interesting to me. There are a lot of things you have to worry about, being in the right place to make a interception, being in the right place to make a tackle, and of course the quarterbacks are just awesome in their ability to pick out a series of in the West Coast offense, you go through a series of receivers and you check them off, and you finally pick the one that appears to be optimal, and so your brain is working at a high rate of speed to do these sorts of estimations. You got to know where they are compared to where you've been practicing the throw. It's just quarterbacks earn their money.
614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Let's listen to another play. OSU fans might remember this one. In a game versus Indiana, OSU's Ted Ginn Jr. Literally sprints the length of the football field, dodging everything in his way. Let's listen.
Austin Starr, end-over-end kick. Ted Ginn Jr. from the three. Look out! Look out! Nobody will catch him. Secretariat at the Belmont, ahead of the field, touchdown!
The play call in that clip calls again the Secretariat at the Belmont, comparing him to the greatest racehorse there ever was. You call this ankle forces. Tell us about speed from a physics standpoint.
Yeah, Ginn is a remarkable player in that he's got both quickness and speed, which, for example, Jerry Rice did not have. But he's so when the announcer there is bellowing, "Look out, look out!" He is making cuts that just juke your socks off. They're amazing how rapidly he's changing direction. So, of course, we learn from the first law that the way you change direction is to apply a force. In this case, you push off with your foot onto the ground. The third law tells us that it's actually the ground pushing on you that provides the force giving you the acceleration to change direction. And when you use the second law to calculate how much force that is, it turns out there's about 800 pounds of force running through your ankle and your knee. This is how ankles and knees get blown out. But then, of course, after he's dodged these players, he then puts it into fourth gear, and he's just insanely quick, insanely fast is what I should say, to be precise, and just blows past all the defenders because he could just run like the wind.
My guest is Timothy Gay. He's written a book. It's called The Physics of Football. If you have a play out there that you're been wondering about all these years and want to know how it happened or what happened, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Coming up in hour number two of All Sides with Ann Fisher this morning, the guests will be Zach Brand, Vice President of Digital Media, Steve Fox, of Editorial Director and Vice President of PC World, and Russell Holly of Geekcom, and they will talk with Ann about connected cars, consumer technology, and gadgets.
89.7 NPR News brings you local, national, and international news all day, every day. On 89.7 FM, hear the BBC News Hour, All Sides with Ann Fisher, Fresh Air, On Point, and Talk of the Nation. 89.7 NPR News is your all-day NPR news station. Listen on the radio or stream our service anytime online at wosu.org.
Well, it's hardly a winter's day today. High about 59 degrees. Showers are likely later on, a low of 46 overnight. And then on Wednesday, showers likely tomorrow morning, then becoming gradually sunny and a high of 54 degrees. Goodness gracious.
On the next Fresh Air, the coming tsunami of slime in the presidential campaign. Journalist Joe Hagan says the emergence of super PACs has changed the game, bringing an unprecedented flood of special interest money to fund opposition research and negative ads. Hagan's article was published in New York Magazine. Join us.
Terry Gross and Fresh Air coming up at 12 noon here at NPR News 89.7.
Welcome back. My guest is Timothy Gay, a physics professor at the University of Nebraska. He's also author of the book, The Physics of Football, Discover the Science of Bone-Crunching Hits, Soaring Field Goals, and Awe-Inspiring Passes. Is there a play out there that's befuddled you for a long time, and you've always wondered, how did it happen? How could they do that? Give us a call. Timothy Gay might be able to answer your question. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I want to get to another cut in a second, but I also wanted to ask you, are you going to the Super Bowl this year?
No, I won't be able to go. I got to teach.
Okay. Does your knowledge of the physics of football distract you as a football fan, as an aficionado?
That's a great question. Somebody asked a famous physicist once, you know, why do you study physics? Because it ruins your appreciation of a rainbow when you see a rainbow in the sky. And his response was, no, I have the human reactions that everyone has to the beauty, the aesthetics of the rainbow, but I also can appreciate the physics that's going on to make that rainbow. And I think the wonderful thing about studying physics is that you can see an exciting game like football. It is, after all, the best game there is. And you get all the excitement and all the sort of normal fan stuff, but you can also see when you see a punt turning over or not turning over and seeing how that affects what the receiver has to do. You appreciate the physics of the motion of the ball through the air. So it's just an enriching aspect of being a fan.
And I was also wondering, the book is a few years old now. Is there any reason to update it for new classes of physics students out there?
The book has actually been in, this is the second edition of the book now, and aside from some physics mistakes and typos that were corrected from the first edition, the real change was using more modern players. I came of age when people like, you know, Lawrence Taylor and Dick Butkus were big guys, and now of course all that's changed. And I have a lot of friends that follow the NFL very closely and can tell me who all the great players are. I watch a few NFL games for my favorite team, the Patriots, but I don't watch all that much that I know every detail of every personnel change.
When you're watching a game, do you you see a certain kind of a play, do you go, I'm going to get that on tape because it'll be a good example of something I'm teaching?
Yeah, my wife actually complains about this. She said, you know, because occasionally I'll sit there and everybody else is drinking beer and eating popcorn and screaming, and I'm sitting there with a notepad making notes on what I should talk about on this specific play. So I've recently done some work with football helmets, and I spent a lot of time staring at the screen trying to figure out which player is wearing what helmet. So sometimes it's a little distracting.
Stephen in Lakewood, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Stephen. Hello, Stephen.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yep, can hear you great.
Okay, great. Yes, my question for the gentleman would be, with all things being equal in physics, yesteryear versus today, could Jim Brown be able to repeat the acclaim that he had back then? Could he do it today?
Yeah, I'm prejudiced because I happen to think that's a great question. I happen to think that Jim Brown is maybe the greatest running back ever. I know I'll get a lot of controversy there, but in my opinion, and this is really more me speaking as a football fan than as a physics professor, but Brown had incredible reflexes and incredible reaction time, and it allowed him to get around people, and quickness, I might add, which is of course essential for a running back. So he would certainly be great in this era. The question is, would he be a Jim Brown in this era? And again, I think a talent at the level of Jim Brown or Dick Butkus or Lawrence Taylor comes along once in a century, or three times in a century, in this case. But I think a great player will be great in any era. And so my answer to your question would be yes. But again, I'm speaking more as a fan than as a physicist.
Thanks, Stephen.
Thank you.
Take care. If you want to talk to our guest, Timothy Gay, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We do have an email from James. He writes, a replay of Cundiff's missed goal attempt showed the holder wasn't able to line up the ball stitching to face forward. Instead, the stitching was at about 45 degrees from forward facing. How much would this affect the flight of the ball?
Yeah, thanks for that question. That's a great question, and it gets back to this issue I had for the woman that called in. It doesn't have a huge effect, but these effects multiply. Now that field goal was not a particularly long field goal. Of course, I think one announcer referred to it as a chip shot. Well, it was a chip shot that missed. And those kinds of asymmetries, the fact that the laces were not perfectly aligned, can add to the problem of aiming. I mean, they do add to the problem of aiming. So I would estimate that that was part of the problem, if not the whole problem. That's why they have to practice these things over and over. Getting that ball placed in the same place over and over again is crucial. In this business of field goal kicking or punting, you know, repeatability is just crucial. And doing the same thing over and over is what these guys strive for, and clearly that criterion was not met on that attempt.
Gene in Clintonville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Gene.
Thank you. The original 63-yard field goal by a professional was by Tom Dempsey.
Right. Thanks.
And incidentally, he didn't have any toes on his right foot, and he had a squared-off shoe.
Right.
But what I wanted to talk about was that he kicked in the old style, where he lined up in a straight line among himself, the ball, and the goalpost. And that style has been abandoned now, totally in favor of the soccer style, right?
That's correct, and you're making a great point here. Dempsey was born without toes on one foot, so he had as you point out, he had a boot that was squared off, and of course that gave him, if you will, an unfair advantage, because that makes the kicking situation more symmetric and reduces this problem we talk about of aiming. Now people have entirely gone over to a soccer style kick simply because instead of kicking the ball with the toe, you're kicking it with the side of your foot, which means that you can accurately place your foot more easily. And the accuracy has gone up as a result of that. So this is an example where I'm sure that the kickers weren't sitting around thinking carefully about the physics of this, but it really does. It is a common sense physics result, which is that if your foot is to the side, you can place its angle more accurately than you can place the position of your toe if you're kicking in the old style. Dempsey's 63-yarder was certainly aided by his boot.
Okay, but the soccer style kickers are getting more distance. Is that a matter of foot speed?
That's a great question. I'm not well. When you say distance, it is certainly true that they kick more accurately from further away. But I don't think that's an issue of foot speed. That's an issue of aiming. There are the two things. There's the aiming issue. There's the foot speed issue. Now, having said that, I'm going to think about your question carefully when we get off the air, because when you rotate your ankle to do the soccer style kick, I'm sure there is some, you know, kinesiological, physiological effect on your foot speed, and you've raised a question I've never really thought about before, which is what happens to foot speed when you rotate the foot, and you know, I'm 99% sure nobody's ever looked into that, but it's something that should be looked into.
Gene, you've stumped.
Has anybody ever quantified that? And you've just answered that.
Okay, yeah. You've stumped the expert, Gene.
Yeah. I didn't mean to do that.
good.
That's okay.
That's a great
Thanks
question.
Thanks a lot for your call. Let's listen to one more cut. Physics does not just apply to the offensive side of football. Let's listen to a clip related to the defense. This is the NFL now, the Eagles versus the Saints.
Reggie Bush lines up as the tailback. Reeves swings it out to Bush, and the ball is knocked away, and an incomplete pass, and a crunching hit put on by Sheldon Brown, and Bush takes a while to get up, and now goes down again.
He did not see that hit coming. He was looking back at the ball. That was a blind hit right there.
A great defensive scheme by Jim Johnson because he brought pressure, but he still had Sheldon Brown out in the flat to come and put up a big hit. Reggie Bush was completely exposed.
And maybe an early message by the Philadelphia Eagles defense on the road against the Saints. Timeout. We'll be right back.
And in comes the groovy NFL music. That was Sheldon Brown of the Eagles really hitting Reggie Bush of the Saints. Such a huge hit. It flattens Bush to the ground and knocks the football out of his hands.
That hit is one of the biggest I've ever seen in the NFL, and it's a thing of beauty. That's one of the things I love to do when I played football was hit guys, and it's a beautiful, beautiful hit. Now, the interesting thing about that, there's a reason they call football a contact sport, and you can use Newton's second law to calculate the force of that hit to be about 3/4 of a ton. The technical physics term for that is getting your bell rung, and it's incredible. The ball just goes sailing off, it's too bad we don't have the video of that because he's just crawling around for about a minute after that, just completely oblivious to what's going on around it. But when you tackle properly, you can exert these kinds of forces. Again, you know, 3/4 of a ton.
Michelle in Worthington, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Michelle.
Hi there. Thank you. First of all, I want to ask, where can I get your book?
Amazon.com.
Probably the local bookstore, too.
Barnes & Noble. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
I'm excited about this. Thank you very much. I have 3 boys that play football. My middle son is a freshman, and currently he is ranked 2nd in the nation for long snapping for the class of 2015.
Cool.
Yeah, we're really excited for him, and he's very excited. We're noticing on his tapes, when he gets critiqued, he goes to a lot of the national camps. There's one group in particular that he goes, and they teach a lot of technique there as well. And the gentleman who teaches is saying that he's not using his lower body enough. He's about 6'2", about 175 pounds, and he's already been clocked at speeds that are under 0.7 seconds.
Okay.
So what I'm interested in knowing is, can you kind of talk a little bit about the physics of long snapping and the importance, if it is really, which I'm assuming it is because they're teaching this, the importance of the lower body and kind of mechanically, how does that work? Because I want to be able to talk to him about this.
Right.
And I want to get that book, too. So thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thanks for your question. I agree that the forward body motion is important because you're essentially putting more force, instead of just using the mass of your arms, you're using the force of your entire body. So I think that's correctly something the coaches are telling him. Again, you know, it's kind of the same issue as kicking. It's ball speed, getting the ball up to a good speed, and then you know, accurately aiming it. So that's not so much physics, it's more common sense. So but it sounds like your son is a candidate for the NFL, and I wish him the best of luck. I wanted to make one point about the book. The book is really, I wrote the book with high school football players in mind. The book is really, as I was putting things down on paper, I was thinking about high school coaches and even more so high school football players, to give them kind of an appreciation of the technical demands that are being put on them.
Thanks, Michelle.
Yes, thank you so much.
Yep, and we re-air at 7 p.m. if you want to plop them down and make them listen to the show.
Oh, I'm going to, believe me.
All right. Thanks a lot. We have time, let's see, for a couple, hopefully one more question. It's from an email from Jim in Johnstown. He says, my mom hit the back of her head in a fall and had a brain bleed at the front. She's fine. This seems to be caused by the brain rebounding within the skull and hitting the opposite side. Do you have any analysis of whether this is responsible for many football head traumas in spite of excellent helmets?
That is certainly... The cause is the helmet head interaction and specifically rebounding off the padding. It's important to point out that I believe there's not a football helmet out there that can prevent concussions. They will lower the severity over time. They might increase the time to onset of a severe symptom related to a concussion. But basically, helmets as they exist today are not going to solve this problem. Some helmets are better than others, but football is a dangerous sport. Let's be honest about this. One, there have been a lot of proposals about things to do. One suggestion that I kind of like is to get rid of the helmets altogether. This will remove the player's sense of invincibility. It's an interesting thing to think about.
Rugby?
It would turn the game into rugby, sort of. But I think it's important, especially for parents of younger players, to realize that those helmets are not a panacea. They are not going to necessarily, again, bumps and bangs, sure, you got to wear the helmet, but in a big hit, especially if you have a player that's trying to spear you, you know, they're not going to prevent a concussion.
You know, there is a lot of talk just recently about the dangers of football and hockey as well.
Yes.
Knowing what you know about the physics of the game, does it affect your enjoyment of it ever? When you're seeing someone, you get their, what is it, their bell rung?
I will be honest. One of the things I love about football is the big hits. I love the violence of the game. It's what I liked as a player, even though I wasn't very good at it. The thing I wonder about, but it is absolutely true that football is a dangerous sport, and I just don't. I wonder where that's gonna end up.
Well, we're at the end of this interview, and I want to thank you so much, Timothy Gay. Really enjoyed it.
Thanks so much for having me in.
Timothy Gay is a physics professor at the University of Nebraska, Lincoln. He is the author of the book, The Physics of Football, Discover the Science of Bone-Crunching Hits, Soaring Field Goals, and Awe-Inspiring Passes. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.